We'll move on to the second part, so to speak, of this case. Give counsel a time to put their thoughts back together for this transition. And when you're ready, you can proceed. Appears that everyone is in their places and everyone is ready to go forward.
Thank you.
Please proceed. And if you wish to reserve any time.
I appreciate the opportunity to reserve about 4 minutes at least, if I can, Your Honor. Mark Solomon, on behalf of the co-settler and the co-trustee of the ATS Trust, Susan Pillsbury, who's present in the gallery. As Your Honors know, we're here because the district court refused and failed to enforce the trust no contest clause, even though Laura's petition that she filed is itself prima facie violation of the no contest clause, and despite, you've already heard about the prior dismissal order, the prior dismissal order that was final, that itself, by its own terms, negated any enforceable right by Laura, or in fact, any good faith by Laura.
Mr. Solomon, let's just say, for the sake of argument, to speed this one along for both, let's say we agreed with you on that. What about the statute, though? Doesn't that save the claim that Laura filed?
It does not, Your Honor.
Okay, tell us why.
You want to hear the analysis of the statute? That's fine. All right. let me do it this way. What the district court held, in essence, was, if you take a look at what we call the no contest order, is that Laura had sought an accounting. And she sought an accounting under 163.137. And it was rejected. There was a letter went out and said, we're not going to give it to you. And that statute says that you have so much time, 30 days, I believe, after your request for accounting has been rejected, within which to file a petition to compel the performance of that account. And in that, the statute says that you can include any request in that petition under 153.031. And that's exactly, and then what the district court did is said that because that statute authorized her to file an accounting, she could file anything she wanted to with respect to 153.031 that statute authorizes. And if you look at her petition, everything she alleged, that the marital trust is invalid, that she had a right to the marital trust, and she had a right to the survivor's trust, were all statutorily authorized. But that cannot be the law for a number of reasons. 153.031 authorizes any type of petition with respect to any aspect of the trust. And this court's already held in the Lithicum case versus Ruby that doesn't mean, if your honors remember, that's a case where some beneficiaries, remainder beneficiaries, tried to bring a current petition while the trust was still revocable. And this court held that they don't even have standing under 153.031. So here we have a series of contests that Laura brought that are directly within the clear and unambiguous language of the no contest clause, one that she was required to fund the marital trust and the exemption trust, and instead that Susan wrongfully terminated it and disposed of its assets, clearly seeking to attack, oppose, or set aside the administration distribution of the trust, to defeat or change the trust provisions, and to assert a claim to trust assets she didn't have, which are the three things that are set forth in the no contest clause clearly and unambiguously. And in the dismissal order, that the court had entered on May 8, 2014, where it adopted the probate commissioner's report and recommendation in its entirety, finding the fact, number five, said there's no requirement to fund the marital or exemption trust after Andy's death, and Laura did not use due diligence in seeking to determine the existence of any of her claims. Those are unappealed. And under the State of Herman case of this court, that's final. That dismissal order negated her claims that she was enforcing the trust terms under 163.00195 subsection 3. It negated that she was enforcing her rights as a beneficiary under that trust, and that's the marital and the exemption trust. Similarly, and even perhaps even more strongly, that her petition also claimed that Susan was required to establish and maintain the survivor's trust for Laura's benefit, and that Susan wrongfully terminated that, and now Susan must return the assets and account to Laura for all the assets in the survivor's trust. There's no question, then, by the plain language of the petition, she sought to attack, oppose, and set aside the administration and distribution of the trust, defeat or change trust provisions, and assert a claim to trust assets in which she had no interest. In its dismissal order, the district court adopted report and recommendations findings 11, 12, and 13. That Susan was the sole beneficiary of the survivor's trust during her lifetime, had the right to revoke and terminate, and was not required to notify its termination to Laura. Adopted conclusion law 16 that she had not used due diligence in ascertaining the existence of any of her causes of action. Again, that dismissal order negated that she was enforcing the trust terms, and negated that she was enforcing her rights as a beneficiary of the survivor's trust, including her claim for an accounting of that. Now, Laura also claimed that in her petition, that Susan had not provided her or other beneficiaries an accounting since Andy's death. She was still entitled to the same.
Before you leave that, you want us to take the final determination of the claim as proof that it's outside the 163.00195.
But I do.
The language of the statute says it's the action seeks to enforce the terms of the trust. So it's a little different than that it didn't end up enforcing the terms of the trust because the claims were rejected.
Those are two issues, Your Honor. Let me explain. First issue would be, is it a prima facie violation of the no contest clause?
Right, I get that.
And
we're prepared to assume, for the sake of argument, that it does prima facie violate the
right.
No contest clause. My point is, under the statute that says certain actions are exempt, and necessarily so, if you have a trustee who's stealing everybody blind, there has to be some mechanism to address that. The statute is articulated in terms of seeks to,
yes,
et cetera.
Only seek to, which is important in this case.
The only to. I'll credit you the only.
Because every single thing that you seek to do better be only within the scope of that statute.
Sure.
That was the intent of the legislature.
I'll quote you the only as well. But what I'm trying to get to is, why didn't this petition seek to do the things articulated in the exemption to the no contest?
Because she didn't have an enforceable right to any of the things that she asked for. And it was proven that she didn't have an enforceable right under either the trust terms or her rights as a beneficiary when she sought to do so by the fact that the court already ruled she didn't have that enforceable right. And she wasn't seeking to construe trust terms. I mean, let's take an example. She didn't have any rights under the survivor's trust whatsoever, but she pled for relief. She sought relief with respect to that. Was she enforcing the legal right that she had? No, she couldn't be enforcing a legal right. She didn't have the legal right. Was she enforcing the trust terms when she alleged that the marital trust and the exemption trust had to come in, or that she was a beneficiary and the survivor's trust had to stay? No. Because she wasn't seeking to enforce any of her legal rights, the court ruled she didn't have those legal rights. She wasn't seeking to compel compliance with trust terms. Court held that the trust said something different. The legislature added those safe harbors to make sure that when you're not going to implicate a no contest clause when you're merely seeking to enforce legal rights you really have. Or you're really seeking to enforce trust terms. She didn't have any in not one case. And the analysis I was going to go through was to show you in each specific case, the court already ruled she didn't have those rights, and that was before the hearing on the no contest clause. And we pointed all that out, and instead the court relied on this accounting statute that says if a request for accounting is rejected, then you can file a petition to compel that accounting, and you can include in that petition any other relief authorized by 153.031. If that's the interpretation that this court agrees with, throw away no contest clause. It's meaningless. It wipes it out. Because if you can make any claim that's generally authorized by 153.031, that's anything. That actually includes affirming the existence of the
trust. Mr. Solomon, I understand, and I think you're giving us a good common sense argument, but I suspect Mr. Reed's going to get up and say, Supreme Court, you have to interpret the statute the way the legislature wrote it, and it says for seeking, if it uses that language, you have to interpret it that way, even if it does violence to the no contest clause. What's your response to that going to be?
I'm arguing the same thing. I'm saying that she was seeking relief that was prohibited by the no contest clause. And how do we know that in this case? One, you could determine it yourself by just reading their complaint and reading the no contest clause. They're both clear and unambiguous. But on top of that, the district court already agreed with us in its dismissal order. That's why I cited the dismissal order. It's just further proof of the fact that it clearly is in violation of the no contest clause, is not within the safe harbor. Now, the district court never...
Mr. Solomon, you're about 358 at this point.
I'll reserve my time then. Thank you.
Thank you. Lee Freed for Laura Tompkins, respondent. A couple things from just in immediate response. When the court declined to apply the no contest provision, the court did it in light of the statute, but also construing the trust in its entirety. Absent from Mr. Solomon's argument that you just heard is any reference to paragraph 13.1 of the trust. That's important because 13.2 allowed for an accounting. 13.1 provided limited liability protection to the trustee, except only such as may result from their fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. That language has to be given meaning and effect. All of the cases, the statute itself, describing the enforceability of no contest provisions.
And I guess the concern the court may have as we explore that area is whether or not, as this was pled, the pleadings were too broad, or whether or not, from your standpoint, they fit in that safe harbor area.
So the reason, and this is what the court found, and it's supported by substantial evidence in the record, it's not clearly erroneous. What the court found was that the circumstances that led to the filing were a breach of fiduciary duty by Susan Tompkins to Laura.
Where do you get that express finding?
From page 1047 of the record, and it's in the court's order as well, when the court found, so 1047 is the citation to the order. It's in the transcript pages as well.
The written order.
Yeah, the written order. So this is 1047. I believe that would be volume 4 of the
Do you have the okay, number of it. The order, the paragraph number of the order? It's
paragraph number starts at 23 and reads through 26. 23 states that the accounting request was a reasonable request. Paragraph 24 says that Susan, through her counsel, curtly rejected the request, and that the response fell below the standards of courtesy, candor, professionalism that the court would expect from members of the Nevada Bar. It's important to look at what that response included or excluded as compared to what it should have included. Susan's response...
That's not a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, it paragraph...
You said that the district court found that there was a breach of fiduciary duty by the trustee, or maybe I misheard you.
Well, I did say that, and what I meant was that as the trustee, and pursuant to paragraph 13.2 of the trust document, in addition to the statutory requirements, but 13.2 says that when an accounting request is made, the trustee shall provide an accounting. Instead of doing that, and you made reference to the Ms. Harrison's email, but the text of the email says that it doesn't say that there was an accounting provided. There was an accounting that was done in 2007. It doesn't say the trust was administered in accordance with its terms. Here's the accounting. Here's the information. The court found that it was appalled by Susan's response.
Was rude, but it was not legally actionable. And the point is, we're trying to assess whether or not there was a violation of the no contest clause. If so, whether or not, nonetheless, under 163.01, whatever it is, it's in one of the safe harbors.
Yeah. So, but in doing that, the district court first found that the response to the accounting request, and first that it was a reasonable request, that the response to it wasn't just that it was rude. It was that it fell below the standards that were expected.
Mr. Reed, though, if in fact, as was stated previously, prior to the no contest, we dealt with this issue of the accounting first. And if we dealt with the accounting first and the party is aware that they weren't entitled to an accounting because of the statute of limitation issue, then how do we get to this position that the response to the request for an accounting is inappropriate when there was no obligation to give an accounting?
Well, there was still an obligation. It wasn't statutorily actionable. It hadn't been brought within the appropriate period of time. But there was a right under the trust for an accounting to be provided. And
well, they, from one standpoint, they have made an argument that they accommodated those accountings and they even offered documents. But if I take your argument and carry it all the way through, that means today you could stand up and say, we want a fresh accounting.
Well, what Judge Sturman found was that the claims...
I understand what she found. The question is, what was her legal basis to find it?
Well, at the time, we had a request for an accounting. And there the minimum of information which the trustee under the trust was required to provide... wasn't.
But it had been already provided. I mean, that's the point.
That wasn't clear in the record, okay? It was clear that others said it had been done. There was a K-1 that was provided. A K-1 is not the same as an accounting.
I understand.
And the accounting should have been provided at the time it was requested. What was represented by Susan's representative was that disbursements were made at the time Andy Tompkins passed. No other information was provided. And that is what led to the filing of the petition. Filing of a petition was...
But the information and the disbursements had been provided in 2008. So you're talking about re-providing information that had already been provided, right?
Well, the reason there was discovery a year later is because it was shown that an accounting was prepared, but there was no indicia that it had in fact been provided to Laura. There were affidavits provided by other beneficiaries saying, yeah, we saw it before. We believed that Laura had it too. But the reason there was ongoing back and forth was...
Laura said she was omitted from the distribution.
Right, and it's clear that she was. There was not evidence shown that she was provided the accounting at any time. The receipt of the K-1 is what turned the discussion, saying because you got a document that said this is a final distribution, you were on inquiry notice at that time to start asking. Now, with that factual background, let's talk about the claims and the statutes. I think the other side relies on the Redmond Tafoya case from New Mexico, the principle that there shouldn't be any deference given to the fact findings below, that a de novo standard applies. Now, Nevada law indicates this court has other rulings that say there should be deference given to the fact findings. I mentioned the Redmond Tafoya case because I think it's extremely instructive as to the outcome that that this court should render based on the facts of this case, irrespective of the standard of review that applies, which I do think is substantial evidence. But just because there were acts that made the administration difficult, other hurdles, they were not claims to do anything other than to enforce the terms of the trust. And so when you look at the petition that Laura filed and the requests that were made, they were not seeking to overturn the intent of her father. They were directly focused on ensuring that his desires were fulfilled. She was not seeking to do anything other than to have the court render an order that the terms of the trust should be followed, that Susan should be confirmed as a trustee, that an accounting should be performed and provided as required in section 13.2 of the trust, and as Judge Sturman found, the remainder of the claims flowed from the language of the trust. She wasn't asking for anything other than that. The parsing of the language, the twisting of the relief sought, as Mr. Solomon describes, is inconsistent with NRS 163-00195. It really does ignore the safe harbor provisions. The Nevada legislature's recent amendment of the statute confirms what has always been true, which is that the court shouldn't be looking for a means to to enforce or to cause a forfeiture unless the no contest provision is read very strictly and very, very narrow.
Could I pause you for a moment? I was trying to think as I read the no contest provision in the pre-2017 statute, yes, and your petition, what lanes weren't made that theoretically could have been made that the statute would apply the no contest clause to? I mean, that's a very wide-ranging petition, and so...
Well, still, the text of the no contest provision, Laura was not seeking to establish or assert any claims to the assets of the trust other than what the... She was seeking to have enforced what the trust said.
Well, but she was saying that she was entitled to a distribution that had already been made.
That isn't outside of the no contest provision. And it's also consistent with the safe harbor provision, which is if you're seeking to enforce the rights that you have under the terms of the trust. So
give me an example of a claim that a beneficiary of a trust could make under this trust's no contest provision and this statute that would fail, in other words, that would violate the no contest and that the statute would that's right.
The cases are clear. The case I cited, the Redmond Tafoya case, where you're seeking to when it affects the capacity of the document wasn't signed with capacity, that it's null and void for certain reasons. But those types of claims would be outside, would fall under the no contest and would result in a forfeiture.
Anything else?
The document was invalid, but the language of 13.1, which cannot be ignored and has to be read to have effect because it is part of the settler's intent here, does authorize claims for fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. And that was what was brought when... Ms. Harrison, Susan's representative, said, you're not getting an accounting, and the trust doesn't exist anymore. And that was the information that was provided.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by dispelling the finding of the district court that the request for accounting was reasonable. 13.2 of the trust says the trustee must render accounting only upon written request of an income beneficiary. In 2012, when that request was made, she was no longer an income beneficiary. She was a former beneficiary. Not a current beneficiary is defined by 165.128. She's not a remainder beneficiary is defined by 165.132. And under 165.137A, she's not, therefore, entitled to an accounting. On top of that, she was already ruled by a binding order that even if she was, she requested it too late. So how could she possibly have any legally enforceable rights? And the request for accounting was unreasonable because she wasn't entitled to it. I mean, how can the court say, and the court actually said this in arguments in this minutes order, that she had an absolute right to an accounting? How can you have an absolute right to an accounting when the court rejected it? And said you don't. I mean, the finding is wrong. But even if she did, our argument is by using the word only and by the way the statute's constructed, each contest that you submit must fall within a safe harbor provision. And if you don't, then you have triggered it. And so, how could Laura be seeking to enforce the terms of the trust if the relief she's requesting is inconsistent with the terms of the trust? as it obviously was, and as it was found Bott to be by the district court in multiple instances. How could she be enforcing a beneficiary's right, legal right, under the terms of the trust, where there's no rights exist, either because they've been wiped out by the statute of limitation, or because she's pleading wrongfully in violation of the terms? And the classic example is that survivor's trust. She's saying Susan must pay it back. By the way, survivor's trust, of course, was all Susan's assets. So she never had a right to it. It was always revocable. But she didn't plead that way. She pled specifically and clearly that she had, Susan had an obligation to reconstitute that and keep it alive for her benefit. That is clearly not seeking to enforce a beneficiary's rights, because there's no rights exist.
So, Mr. Solomon, her status when this action was filed was that of a beneficiary who had been paid their request exactly. Under the terms of the trust.
Exactly.
Okay.
One thing that hasn't been mentioned here, I don't think in either argument, is that Laura had the same accountant. That was found in the dismissal order, findings of fact. She had the exact same accountant, Joe Wyckoff, who represented Susan in doing the accounting, in doing the distribution reports. Joe Wyckoff prepared Laura's 2008 tax return with the final K-1, which he had also prepared. And there is no evidence, no statement at all as to why Laura, if she was really confused, why didn't she pick up the phone and call Joe Wyckoff, her own accountant, and say, tell me what's going on here. She didn't do it. Talk about bad faith. And if she had, she would have learned everything that Jay Larson and Elizabeth Brickfield told Mr. Reed after she already launched ahead and made both conclusions that somehow her rights had been violated when in fact they had not.
I have a question, may I?
Go ahead.
Mr. Reed points to page 5 of the court's order and the statement respecting courtesy, candor, and professionalism. And I wanted to understand your response to that.
Sure.
And what transpired, because it does seem to me that this slipped away from everyone.
Your Honor, what you don't know, maybe, is the record, the full record in this case, that shows that Laura actually started the campaign in early 2012. She started badgering all these emails are in the record before the court.
But briefly, what address the professionalism issue?
I will, but that's the background of that response, which is admittedly curt. But read it yourself. I'm sure you have read it yourself. There's nothing unprofessional in there. I mean, what I think the district court felt was that, well, maybe Susan's attorney should do more to inform Laura than what she did in this simple thing. But then why didn't she contact her own accountant to get that information,
okay.
Number one? But the background I was trying to get into, there was already
acrimony
between them. Susan, she had already called Susan a thief. Susan had already wrote a letter saying, I'm not going to include you in my distributions of my assets, my community property, based on what you're doing here. She had already accused her of wrongfully administering the trust.
So there was bad blood at this point,
yes.
But there was no finding of legally actionable misconduct.
Clearly not.
Okay.
I think the court's concept was that, well, maybe if she'd given Laura everything she asked for immediately, then maybe Laura wouldn't have done it. But we know that's not true, because even after we gave Laura everything that she asked for in the Jay Larson letters and Elizabeth Brickfield, and we said, please, don't go forward. We're going to invoke the no contest clause. She went forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court thanks counsel for both sides for the spirited arguments as well as enlightening this court as to facts and law related to the cases. Both of the cases, 67040 and 68748 will stand submitted this day.